everybody wants to save energy, have safe food, be kind to the planet, up to a point. Do we know where that point is? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Is the public ahead of the policy sector, or is the policy sector just more pragmatic? Human nature, selfish or altruistic? That's the big picture subject today. Our number, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Email talk@APRN.org. Alaskan Charles Wolforth is our guest today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Well, bad enough, Charles, that you got to write a book entitled The Whale and the Supercomputer. Now you follow it up with one, and I quote, the title of which is The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. You're certainly one for the big picture.
I do tend to take on big topics. You know, this book came out of The Whale and the Supercomputer, which was a book about climate change in the Arctic and the way that we perceive it, the way Native cultures perceive the changing climate and the way that science perceives it. And I was presenting to a group in Barrow, a group of rural development students from all around the state, from villages everywhere. And one of the young women there said, well, okay, you've told us about how we perceive the environment. Now tell us how we do something about it. And that was about 6 years ago. And that set me on a really long journey to sort of figure out, well, just at base, you know, how do we do something about it? Because we're not really accomplishing that much.
Yeah. Well, I can't even imagine how you managed to, your agent maybe, managed to convince a publisher to take such a vast scope that this book does and think that somebody's going to buy it and read it.
Well, you know, once people start reading it, they seem to like it. And selling a book is all about the writing, you know, how it reads. There's a review in the Newsminer this weekend where the reviewer said that she couldn't stand to start the book because it looked so big. It sat around all summer, but that once she started reading it, she couldn't put it down. And I think it's a story about Alaska and our history and about the way we have treated our environment and what our cultures teach us about how we treat our environment. And that's something that affects every single person. You know, it's something that if you don't have a part in that, then you're really not a human being.
Well, at the base, it would appear to me that you're talking about, first, we always know and you're conscious, and I think most Alaskans really are conscious, but somehow get schizophrenic about it. But, you know, there have been people here for, you know, probably 20,000 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But the dominant culture, let's say, or the dominant cultural paradigm is the Western culture and comes out of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, I don't even know if they teach the Enlightenment in college anymore. Very odd, but these are, if you don't know the ideas from which our democratic theory of government and so forth come, you're really missing out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because of our roots. These ideas have basic roots in things like natural law and human rights and things like that, the social contract. And really, Alaska, if you go all the way back to when the Russians began arriving in Alaska, Alaska really does kind of date, in terms of its relationship with the Western culture, to the Enlightenment.
Well, that's a story that I'm trying to tell. And for those who whom the Enlightenment is a vague term, you know, it goes back to writers like Thomas Hobbes, who lived in a time of a lot of warfare in Europe. And he essentially concluded that mankind's natural state is warfare, that we tend to always look out for ourselves. And that's really all that's important to us, and that the only thing that keeps us from killing each other is powerful government. And on that basis, philosophers like John Locke developed ideas about how, well, you could create a system of democratic government where you'd have different checks and balances, and this would be a way of stopping this natural warfare of humanity. Catherine the Great in Russia read these philosophers and believed in total laissez-faire capitalism. That is the idea that what's going to work best is everybody fighting it out for themselves. And that's why the fur traders who came to Alaska in the 18th century started ripping the place apart, enslaving and murdering the Aleuts, because that was the philosophy that they were sent with. And in fact, a lot of people don't know this. They didn't just murder the Aleuts. They murdered each other. There were different companies here that had pitched battles to fight for the territory so that they could strip the state of sea otters and other fur bearers. And that is the introduction that Alaska Native cultures get to Western culture. And I try to depict, you know, the Native culture is sort of the flip side of that. You know, cooperative villages where people have to live together. In the Chugach region, anthropologists tell us they really didn't have their sense of property was a joint sense. Individuals didn't even own things. They had, you know, a village would have a territory, and basically everything in that territory belonged to the village. And you overlay that with the Russians showing up, with Captain Cook showing up, and you've got a pretty dramatic conflict. And so the question I get to in the book is, well, which is the right way? And I think that we're used to thinking of the competitive way as really being the only way. But in fact, probably more people have lived on Earth the other way, or at least over more of Earth's history. And so both are valid.
But did they have progress, Charles? Did they have progress? Western culture is about progress. I think something that's very interesting that you do in this book is, first off, you know, I've known you since you were a kid.
Yeah, that's right.
you really started your journalistic career with the Exxon Valdez oil spill in a way you'll never get out of it in your entire writing career, because you're still there in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You're still there in this. You go back to Chinigo Bay. Tell us about that, because that's interesting. Here's a community that's been wiped out several times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, those, in a way you could say that's the most unlucky of Alaskans, the tragedies that they've endured with the, first with the invasion of the Russians and the decimation of the population and damage to the culture, then with as they're sort of rebuilding that community, the 1964 earthquake kills over a third of the residents and they go into a diaspora. They're gone for 25 years. They rebuild the village and then very soon after are hit with the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So it's kind of a microcosm, if you will, of the things that have hit this state, which, you know, we're not very conscious of history in Alaska, but these are things that stick with you and they're historical traumas that you really don't get over. And you brought up the oil spill. Yeah, I haven't gotten over the oil spill either. Writing those chapters was really difficult. And seeing the BP oil spill this summer and seeing all of it repeated all over again was also really difficult.
Even though it kind of put you in the spotlight for the press and maybe sold a couple of books.
Ironically enough, yeah, my writing career got started with the Exxon spill, and then this spill spurred my publicity for my book. But what it forces you to look at is, well, if an oil spill is a symptom of something that's wrong with our relationship to the ecosystem in which we live, well, let's go a little deeper. Let's look beyond the symptom and figure out what the disease is. And that's sort of what I try to do in the book. And now I'm required by my agent to remind you that the name of the book is The Fate of Nature, and my website is fateofnature.com.
Good. Well, yes, and the subtitle is Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth, which indicates that you think there is such an ability and maybe even such an inclination. Now, I opened the show by talking a little bit about people's inclination, but I said up to a point. And now I'm wondering about that point, whether maybe our picture of ourselves as a civilization has got something wrong about where that point is in terms of what we're willing to give up in order to altruistically do what's necessary to, whatever, curtail carbon dioxide emissions, for instance.
Right. Well, and I talk about the native cultures who really did live in this cooperative way, you know, that really worked together. But then I know that people aren't necessarily going to believe that, because we're so inculcated with the idea that human beings are basically selfish, basically competitive. So I spent time at the University of Indiana in Bloomington with Lynn Ostrom, who not long after that became the first woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. And what she's done is scientifically shown that people really do have these inclinations, that when we're left outside of a system where competition is forced on us, we generally prefer to have social connections. And this idea of connections is something that I think is kind of the core of the solution. There's one view of human nature is we're all selfish. We're all I. We all want only what's best for ourselves and maybe our offspring.
And somehow through the magic of competition and this invisible hand, everything is going to work out because everybody's doing it.
Right. That's the Enlightenment idea. The other idea is, which actually proves to be scientifically more accurate, is that when we have the opportunity, we have these pro-social tendencies, which means that we put a high value on our connections to other people and to places and to the things that we love that are not monetary, that do not have to do with just selfishness. And the question is, are those values, which I think we all really instinctively know are there, can they be expressed? Can we act on those, or are we forced only to act in this other setting that's given to us? And I think we can. I think there's examples out there where we do. And the real question is, and that's when I say our ability to rescue the earth, it's built in, it's part of us. The question is, can we change the system? Can we change the way we work with each other to make those be realized? And I'm not predicting we will, but I'm saying that that is a possibility.
You're not.
I'm not saying it's going to happen. No, I mean, I think we live at a time of amazing
drama. What the matter with you? You're not.
Well, I mean, look at the climate change issue. To deal with that issue is going to take a basic social movement that changes really the way people view the environment. And we're not going to deal with it from a technocratic top-down way. Well, the question is, can that movement happen in time? You know, the ocean is becoming acidified. The polar ice cap is melting. We live in a time of drama when we don't know what the ending of the story is going to be.
I suppose this is the point where I should look to one of your case studies. What you do is you have some people in the book that you come back to from time to time. And one batch, which is interesting, is some beach cleanup people. People you wouldn't expect to really be involved in this, and yet there they are. And it's almost become an obsession with them. And they know they can never succeed. They're actually trying to do something impossible. They're knowing it's impossible, and yet they're throwing everything they've got into it. And where are they going? Gore Point, all the way out on the outer coast, someplace nobody but fishermen even ever goes.
Right, right. And one of them says, what we're trying to do is like cleaning up all the stars from the sky. You know, 40,000 miles of Alaska coastline, we kind of clean up all the garbage from it. Obviously can't be done. So why not give up? Well, because you've got that drive inside that, you know, once you do it, once you see the difference you can make on one beach, you've got this drive that you've got to do it. And I think that's how we get there. I none of us as an individual really has an ability to deal with these big environmental problems. You can't fix climate change. I can't fix climate change, but we can change the way we behave. And when people see us, it may change the way they behave. And that's how you create social norms, so that there's a new way of looking at the world. And there's other certainly examples of this happening. You know, the change of racial relations in our country is an example. It didn't happen because somebody passed a law. It happened over a 100-year period, 150-year period, as people sort of saw how a new way of behaving, saw what a new kind of ethic was, taught their children, and slowly the society changes, and then, you know, the laws are changed to catch up with society. And I think that's happening with environmental issues too. I just don't know if it's going to happen fast enough.
Well, I guess for the last 3 years on this program, it's been pretty clear from the nature of the calls into Talk of Alaska that the public wanted to do something about energy. They wanted to do something about climate warming. And yet, you know, when we would have the politicians, the policy people in here, they were really still catching up on all this. And I think we really kind of still have that. Now, some of this might be, let's call it plutocracy. The idea that, that there's moneyed interests that are making money off the way things are now and will spend big to keep things the way they are now, and yet things can't stay the way they are now. So when does something pop over in the policy sector, in the Congress or whatnot, when money has a stranglehold? It would seem that that's kind of a pinch point right now.
Yeah. Well, I think what we've got is a system of government and economics that's based on a model of human nature, which really doesn't prove to be true. you know, that our system of government was set up and our economy was set up on the idea that competition is really the way to get things done. And the problem is, in a finite ecosystem, competition is only going to take you so far. Eventually, you're going to run up against the limits of where you live, and that's what's happening now. On the other side, you've got regular...
And then you end up with monopoly, usually.
Well,
you wipe one another out until there's only one left, or maybe a couple of them left, and they have this uneasy thing that they do.
Right, or you know, the system simply collapses, and another, you know, when you look at ecology, that's what usually happens, is a dominant species gets too big, and you have a system collapse. Now, what I see, you know, if you talk to regular people and say, well, what's the most important thing to you? Do you have to have more wealth all the time? Is there ever going to be a point when you have enough wealth? Well, most people say, no, of course not. You know, I'd rather spend time with my family. I'd rather spend time outdoors. You know, there's this idea of sufficiency, that you get enough. You don't have to keep getting more and more. Now think about a politician who came out and said, well, folks, you know, there's a level of sufficiency for our economy. It doesn't need to grow endlessly. It doesn't always have to be more. Well, it's the idea that person would immediately be flushed out of the system. They'd have no chance of success. So how do we get to where our true inner feelings, the way we really see the world, is reflected in our government and our economy? And that's really the struggle that we have. And I think the only way we do it is at the level of person to person, that, you know, that even the most powerful person in society can't ignore its basic social norms, that there's a right and wrong that people believe in, and no matter how powerful you are, that applies to you too. And that's what we have to change.
Okay, these are big questions. We'll just see what the callers have to say about it. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@APRN.org. We're talking human nature with Charles Wolforth, the author of The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. And many times, Charles, you draw back into that the Exxon Valdez spill and the people that you met through there and what's become of them, and for better or for worse, I guess you would have to say. But often for better. In other words, they've evolved, their values have evolved. You know, you look at Ricky Ott, you know, she's leading a crusade. She's not in your book, but, you know, there she is. She's leading this crusade to do something about corporations being persons.
Mm-hmm. It was really hard to be through that experience and not have it change you. And it certainly, as you said, sort of redirected the path of my life. And it's also a really good case study because it's something that everybody can see and everybody can get a sense of, and everybody knows it was wrong. And there's not one human being I know who would look at that oil spill and see those dead animals and you know, not care about it. So why is it we were able to prevent it? You know, why did all our institutions fail and allow this to happen? So it points to this issue of sort of this, that it's a symptom, and what is the solution is these institutions which really don't reflect our basic values. And the other thing is, you know, there was a solution that came out of that, which is Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, which has worked. And the basis of that is local people who live in that ecosystem, who get their sustenance from it, either commercially or recreationally or subsistence, you know, they have a voice. And as a result, that is a very safe shipping system, and another accident is very unlikely. And then as I went around the country talking about the BP oil spill, I had to say, well, why only in Prince William Sound? You know, that model wasn't even repeated in Cook Inlet. You know, Cook Inlet is a very different model that hasn't been as successful, and it certainly wasn't done on the Gulf of Mexico. You know, it's a little bit like if you had a plane crash at Anchorage International because the pilot fell asleep, and so then you gave all the pilots in Anchorage coffee, but you didn't do anything about any of the other airports. You know, it's not an issue of just here. If it works here, it'll work anywhere. And it's a matter of bringing the people who live in that ecosystem, giving them the power, giving them the voice.
That's interesting that you would bring up that the Cook Inlet RCAC would seem to be the same thing, but it's not.
Well, I mean,
it's sort of dominated by government and industry, and somehow government doesn't by itself doesn't carry that same watchdog quality.
Government is really part of the problem.
Geez, I think there's a candidate for the U.S. Senate saying that.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, that this whole liberal conservative dichotomy that we're in is really very false, because liberals need to recognize that government regulation fails when it's too far away from the people who are impacted by the regulation. And that's should have been shown time and time again. Prince William Sound, the Gulf of Mexico,
How about the financial services industry?
Oh, yeah. You know, the government agencies that regulate.
Here these people were. I remember we had a woman on, Catherine Austin Fitz, and she came in and says, they don't understand yet, you know, because basically these guys are just gamblers and they don't even know what they're doing. But they've got this money thing that makes money come out of nowhere, and they're going to keep doing it until something makes them stop. And by golly, that's exactly what happened.
Well, if you turn over these important questions to sort of essentially elite social class, which is a governmental corporate class, then you're going to probably keep getting the same results. But if you go to a setting where communities that actually are affected have voice, then I think you get a different result. And, you know, a couple of the basic differences between Prince William Sound, RCAC, and Cook Inlet is Prince William Sound, the money is mandatory. The folks who run that organization get to decide how every penny is spent. Cook Inlet, they have to justify, as I understand, they have to justify their budget to the industry. Also, the setup of who gets to be on it is very important. So, you know, the details are important, but it's all about bringing it back to the community. And to me, you know, you talk about Lynn Ostrom's work and how do these self-governing communities work? Well, they work when they're able to use the human mechanisms that we use in society. So we punish people socially. Those are the punishments that work. We influence people socially. If you've got a bad actor, you expel them. We should have been able to tell Exxon, you're gone. You can't come back in Prince William Sound anymore. Now, our constitution, our governmental system doesn't let us do that. But, I mean, that is the kind of punishment that would work.
No, I will tell you something. Maybe in a sense it did work. Because one thing that happened, that you were still in the Sound, but here in Anchorage, people began socially ostracizing anyone they knew who worked for an oil company. And this really disturbed management in the industry because, I mean, they're a big part of our community.
Yeah.
They're friends of ours, you know, and all of a sudden people were acting differently towards them, and they felt like they needed to try and patch things up, and they did as best they could to do that. But and I think to some extent that there was an alteration of the actual fundamental values of the oil patch workers in Alaska, that even now, even the people who now work, like maybe they worked for ARCO back then, or maybe they work for Exxon, and now they work for BP, and I can't tell you how many people from the oil patch who work for BP have said to me how embarrassed and angry they are about what their own company did in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. And that's how it works, because the sort of the mechanisms of punishment that we had through the legal system certainly didn't work. They really didn't form any kind of disincentive, and they really didn't punish. But these human interactions, which we really care a lot more about when it comes right down to it, do work. They do influence us. And that's what I try to get into in The Fate of Nature, is how do we strengthen those impulses? How do we put a face on the oil company so that the people who are working there do have those kind of feelings?
Gosh, you know, in a way, you're making an argument for more public fora, such as you and I do. You're doing talk radio right now. I do talk radio. And but, I mean, we're kind of a minority of, if you look at the whole spectrum of talk radio, we got a little tiny educational corner of it, you know, and the whole rest of it is kind of devoted to something else. I don't know. I don't have the good words to describe it, but it's kind of a repeating of a certain paradigm, as it were. And maybe that if we actually had like more real conversation going on, whether it was in like public meetings, in whatever government forums, or just simply hanging out at the bars and the coffee houses and whatnot, you know, if it really went somewhere, it really was allowed to go into some of these territories where it usually doesn't go, like about people's fundamental values.
Right, right. Yeah, even environmentalists don't want to talk about those things. They always want to put it in economic terms and justify themselves that way, which is a losing argument. But I mean, what you say, I think you put your finger on something really strong here, which is using radio as an example. How do we carve out an area where we still have communities, where we can talk to each other and reach consensus conclusions about what we believe? That exists in, you know, native villages around Alaska, but in terms of Anchorage, it's less and less there. One reason is because corporate media doesn't do that. You know, it used to be that there were, you know, if you were a musician years ago, you could get on the local radio station. People would hear your music. You'd start to build a following. Now, almost all radio stations are owned by just a few huge companies. That's been enabled by the federal government.
They don't even have the studio space to have the local musicians in.
It's mostly just, you know, it's just computerized. But public radio, which is supported by the community, still has that setting. And is hugely popular. Steve, I don't know that there's another forum in Alaska that reaches more people than you do in terms of a statewide media voice. So people want it. People pay for it. You know, people pay for our public radio in Alaska. It does work when it has a chance.
They don't want to be deprived of it.
That's right.
Yeah. Could be. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. We're talking to Charles Wohlforth, author of The Fate of Nature, Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. And it's kind of a fascinating subject. Sometimes these value issues are so, for some reason, so slippery and difficult to talk about. Partly, I think it's just embarrassing. Like you came in and you said in self-deprecating terms, you know, well, I'm the flaming liberal that believes people are basically good, you know, and you're embarrassed about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting things about this has been I've been accused of being sort of a wide-eyed, naive optimist. And I respond to the people who say that, well, okay, but what I'm saying is it's not totally inevitable that we're going to destroy the environment. And that makes me a wide-eyed, naive optimist. You know, I'm not saying we're going to save the environment. I'm saying it's not impossible for us to do it. And a lot of people are beyond that point. A lot of people are at the point where they say, well, gee, nobody's going to give anything up, you know. Maybe technology will take care of us, but nobody's really going to sacrifice for anybody else. And that is, to me, the victory of a mindset which is controlled by the competitive institutions, the corporations, and the world of competition is everything. And that's once that mindset settles in, then we're done. Because technology is not going to do the job. You know, we can look at history and see, well, how far have we come in terms of saving energy in our homes in the last 50 years? Huge advances in insulation and efficiency and so forth.
And we just made our homes bigger.
And yet we use more energy to heat our homes than we did 50 years ago because for each person we have four times more space.
But that paradigm might have collapsed already. I sense that people are kind of, they sort of are ready to live a little smaller now.
Well, that's where I see hope, you know, because that is the kind of social norm that moves you in the right direction. Another one is family size. People think, well, that was driven by sort of some evolutionary thing where people, you know, medical care improved, industrialization improved. But in fact, if you look at the record, people started reducing family size way before industrialization. It was a social norm that changed, and it changed as people communicated to each other and they saw. And now, you know, if you think, you know, a family of 12 children is totally anomalous in our society, but once it wasn't. So that's how these norms change, and that's an environmental decision.
So maybe in a sense, there's this kind of cultural, social currency, social cultural, that has kind of made its way over into social media now. And people are like having their social life through with a computer in the middle, in between them. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it's certainly a sign of how we hunger for those connections.
Once it goes through that mediation, somehow then it legitimizes it.
Well, it's easier. I mean, we've been cut off from a community in so many different ways, and here's an outlet for it, and we really hunger for that, and we use it. But it's not the same thing to me. I mean, I think that it's the mind and the body are go together and place, the place you live in is important. And without those connections, I'm not sure you really make those kinds of communities come to life.
Tom in Anchorage, we're going to get to your call in just a moment after the break. Charles Wohlforth is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank, Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Charles Wolforth, there's a point in your book, The Fate of Nature, where you look at people and their values, just in terms of what does a person value? And very few people value wealth. They may value some of the things that money can buy. But it actually turns out that what is most rewarding to people are really things that don't have too much of a price tag on them.
Right. Well, this is one of the really interesting things.
Now, we hear this in church, you know.
Right. Well, it turns out they're right. You know, scientific studies have looked at what makes people happy. And when we're on the materialistic striving, it's actually got a name, the hedonic treadmill. You think of hedonism as is serving yourself and you know, the pleasures of acquisition and so forth. And once you've got those things, you're on a treadmill. You just want more. You don't really get satisfaction from getting that raise because it just puts you in a higher level where you see, wow, I could go even higher. So you put more and more effort into earning these material things. And in fact, there's just research that came out this week that confirms this, is that once you get to a certain level of wealth, more doesn't do you any good. In other words, your measures of happiness and life satisfaction don't go up because you pay a lot of costs for that wealth. You have to work harder for it, and it has other impacts. Whereas if you,
and you have to worry about protecting it.
You have to protect it. You know, it separates you from other people. Whereas the things that do make you happy are tend to be things that have to do with community connection. Believe it or not, volunteerism is one of the highest ones on the list. Dancing, sort of romantic dinners. I mean, this is kind of obvious stuff, but if you think about are sacrificing those things for the material wealth, actually what you're doing is costing the environment, because creating material wealth costs the environment, and taking away from your own life satisfaction. And this is something that we do all the time.
It seems like in Alaska, we're kind of nicely positioned for having more rewarding lives, really, because the world kind of sits out there just waiting for us to get better engaged with it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you think about, I mean, my idea of kind of hell is driving back and forth in Anchorage from one appointment to the next, making my money. And my idea of heaven is getting out of here into Prince William Sound or Kachemak
Bay. Right, you can just replicate that 100,000 times or so.
Everybody,
and you've
got
Anchorage.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we're kind of stuck here. And in a way, that's inevitable because we can't all live a subsistence lifestyle. There's too many of us now. But we can pull back and figure out, well, what really makes us happy? And the thing is, this is not...
Especially when so many of the things that you think you're buying happiness and it's going to come off of some barge someplace, going to cost a hell of a lot. And maybe you didn't want to buy it in the first place.
Well, it's, you know, liberal audiences, conservative audiences, this is not something that is a... That needs to be something that divides people, because once you sit down and think about it, it's really kind of obvious that there is a level of sufficiency, there is a level of enough. Unfortunately, the way our economy works is the value we put on things, both in terms of economics and law and the how we do our courts and how we do our politics, is based on economic value. And the way we set value in economics is how much will you pay for it? Okay, well, you know what? This came up during the Exxon Valdez oil spill. What was that damage worth? They had to figure that out, because the only way you could do it in sort of traditional court measures would be, well, an otter died. Otter pelt's worth about $75. Everybody knew that wasn't going to work. So they have to figure out, well, what is it worth to you as a person? And they even tried to do studies where they ran around the country and saying, well, what would you pay to keep this from happening again? And then they discounted the studies because the numbers were too high. problem is for me, I think, well, what would I pay to have that not happen? Well, I can't imagine anything I wouldn't pay. But then I think, well, I wouldn't give up my, kids' education. Okay. So then put it another way. What would I accept? What could somebody pay me to say, well, let the oil spill happen? Well, I say, well, there's no amount of money I'd accept for that. So these are things that are outside of the economic system. You can't value them. And yet our political and legal system is set up only for things that you can value according to dollars and cents.
Oi. Let's see if Tom has any answers. Tom in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. I called because I think you were getting a little overstated as to what the RCAC has been able to do. And yeah, they're a valuable resource and they do, some research that is necessary. But if you actually look at the impact, of what improved the safety in Prince William Sound and how far we still have to go to get compliance, it was actually OPA 90 and HB 567 that demanded improvements in spill prevention and response. And I'm still litigating that, and still trying to convince the RCAC to come online with a lot of these non-compliance with those laws that are still taking place today. So, it's valuable to have communities that have like interests and have adverse impacts from oil communicate and try and improve the system, but they've been largely ignored by the Coast Guard and DEC when they try and pursue issues, and their contract with Alyeska that provides funding actually prohibits them from taking any litigation action to correct, defects in compliance with the laws when they're ignored by the regulators.
So what? You're just saying that all they really have is if they didn't get any press coverage, they really wouldn't be able to accomplish much of anything?
Well, that's what the situation is. We still have the same spill response system that they put in place immediately after the spill. Essentially, the same set of barges and skimmers, and the BP oil spill shows that there's,
Well, it took a while to get those tugs, as you well know, Tom.
Yeah, but that was OPA 90, and they're not operating them in a manner that can actually arrest the tankers. The tankers are still sailing too close to shore and too fast, going out in extreme conditions where they can't conduct a spill response.
All right. So, Charles, Charles, is Tom destroying your argument here?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't say that this is a perfect solution. I would like to see the local communities have much more power than just a bully pulpit, which is essentially what RCAC gives them. But I think that one can talk about counterfactual, what would it be like without Prince William Sound RCAC? And I would suggest that you probably have the same complacency that took place prior to the oil spill. We only operated 12 years, and that's all it took for all of the systems to essentially erode away to nothing. And there were laws requiring those systems too that didn't work and didn't stay in place. So if you don't have somebody watching over the shoulder, you become more complacent. And I think RCAC has accomplished some things that probably wouldn't have been there that are positive in the tractor times.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I'm not totally bad mouthing them. I'm just saying you need a much better system than what the RCAC represents.
Right.
Tom, do you think, Rick Steiner is going around the world now having RCAC set up all over the place as preventive measures because he's convinced it's a model that works, and now you're calling it into question, Tom.
Well, there needs to be some changes. They have to be independently funded. They cannot be restricted from litigation. Right now, I'm having to litigate those issues that the RCAC has brought up in its contingency plan comments. And, I'm doing it on Social Security disability check.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, Tom. You're doing that with your high-powered legal staff.
I think we're in agreement is that they should be more powerful And we're glad we're there and at least are as powerful as they are.
Yeah.
I would also extend to something that I agree with Joe Miller, the Republican Senate candidate, which is I think that we've gotten way out of line from the original intent of the U.S. Constitution in terms of the ability of local folks to regulate this kind of activity. You know, we originally, when the pipeline was first built, the state of Alaska tried to impose double hulls, which would have significantly reduced the Exxon Valdez or even prevented the discharge of oil. That was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court based on the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, now, that was in 76.
That was right. A long time ago. But what I'm saying is the Constitution doesn't, as currently interpreted by the Supreme Court, doesn't give local communities the power over these kinds of activities that it should. And if we reach much farther with our own local interests, we get struck down. And I hope that, I mean, my hope is that eventually we do bring some of that power back to local communities and local folks. But I think RCAC is as much as we were able to get at that point in time.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. But what I'm saying is you need a better model in that. It, like I said, it has to be independently funded. It cannot be restricted from litigating or against the adversary here, which is clearly the oil industry. And as far as your spill prevention measures, that's a federal law. That's not a state law. That wasn't, you know, that was done by local people who lobbied to get those requirements in place. But it's only the federal government that is actually regulating that aspect of the spill.
Yeah, got your point. Got your point, Tom.
Hate it all.
I've got your point. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
It's Talk of Alaska. Charles Wolforth is our guest, author of The Fate of Nature: Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. Maybe he didn't put the maybe in there. Yeah, well, you know, there's sort of this growth paradigm, and I've tried to nibble away on the edges of it in this program from time to time, suggesting that maybe something other than the gross domestic product needs to be a measure of what we're really after, because clearly, if you can't just keep growing, you know, and some people say, well, then you're anti-growth. Well, yeah, I guess so. But, you know, the thing is, I just think that maybe we need to measure it different or something.
Yeah, well, there's a movement to do that, to mm-hmm. look at measuring gross domestic product in a different way, measuring it in terms of well-being. Because, you know, the way we do measure it, you could say, well, if you've got an inner city kid who's exposed to pollution and he then needs lifelong medication for asthma, that's good. Because you've just increased gross domestic product.
You're That's now, right. You're going to sell all that medicine.
Right. So you do need a different way of measuring it. And but I think that that's really not all. Because what stands between us in some of these things is simply the size and shape of our government, in which I include our corporations, which really have more power over us a lot of times than government does. Where I would differ with those who are sort of the libertarians or the Tea Partiers is they're only worried about the size of government. What about these corporations that have so much influence and so much ability to destroy our environment and the way we live our lives? If you go back to the real thoughts of the founders, you know, the writings of Cato, who inspired the American revolutionists, he believed... and he was actually three people who were writing, but that income inequality is a prerequisite to democracy. That you can't have democracy if you have people who are very rich. And that
boy, that's something to think about.
That's where our American Revolution came from. So do we have real democracy if our real values are unable to be expressed through our political system? I think that's a real question we have to ask, and I'm not sure we do.
Wow. Yeah. Boy, I'm not ready for that. I'm still back with the gross national product,
right.
Gross domestic product. And I'm thinking that there is an unconscious fear. I mean, I think you touched on this a little bit where you said, well, maybe part of this hedonic treadmill. These people have chosen to get on it because they're fatalistic. The system they think is doomed anyway, so they want to get theirs while they can. And so in like measure, it's really intuitively, you know, you just can't have unlimited growth. And so everybody's scared of what would happen when it stops growing. Oh, is it going to collapse? What's going to happen? Yeah, we're going to have the apocalypse, whatnot. We need to start storing food, and indeed people are storing food.
That's true. I think there is a sense a lot of people have of a big crisis, a big change is upon us. But I think that this hedonic treadmill thing is much deeper in terms of our psychology. The experiments show that people really don't know what makes them happy. So one of the experiments is... they do a survey. They ask people, if you suddenly had a windfall, how would you prefer to spend it? And they get to write down something they would buy, or then the other, or give it away. And then they rank. Well, which of these things would make you happiest? Well, they inevitably rank. You know, I'd buy the new motorcycle. I'd go on the vacation. And they rank sort of giving it away at the bottom. Well, then they go out and do these activities, and then they do the survey again, and by golly, it comes out just the opposite way around. The people who gave the money away are much happier than the people who bought something. People who bought something now have something to maintain. They want something else. You can never buy enough stuff. If you give it away, you fulfill that pro-social part of your psychology, which is very real and is there. Why don't you know that that's going to happen? Why are you fooled into thinking that you're only going to be happy doing things for yourself?
Can you imagine if our whole persuasive complex of, you know, it's always saying, there's something wrong with you. If you get this, it'll be better. You know, you're scared of this. Here, get this. You'll be less scared. And instead, it gave the message that you were just giving. Mm-hmm. And it always gave that message with the same consistency that it's now giving the message of fear and inadequacy and insecurity.
Well, and we do. And the charitable messages we receive are usually 100% ineffective in the way they're psychologically approached.
Well, they're put together by industry. That's what the Ag Council is, just the advertising agencies that normally are doing the other commercials.
There's this terrible crisis. Nobody's doing anything about it. You have to give some money.
Feel guilty.
Feel
inadequate.
So then you think, well, I give money, nobody else does. What good's that going to do? But if you go out with the message like, look, everybody cares about these problems. Everybody's contributing. Why don't you contribute too? Psychologically, much more effective message. It's been proven. Same with environmental issues. You tell people, you save energy, you're going to save yourself money, or you save energy, you're going to deal with this terrible problem. They don't save energy.
You save energy because
everybody else is.
We
then
saw
they don't
that
want to do it.
When the Arab oil embargo, as it came to be called, happened, and up until that time, people were insistent on large cars, and they thought that they weren't safe unless they were in large cars, and that vanished just like that. All of a sudden, just happened again.
The
whole U.S. auto industry suddenly wasn't selling cars, and the Japanese were selling every car they could import into the country. But, and what happened was, it was, once again, it was a peer thing. It was not.
Exactly.
That fear was totally a phantom. Mm-hmm. About, I got to have every car because everybody else has one. Well, one day it just poof, gone.
And the environmental economists will tell you that, you know, this panic that went on a couple of summers ago when the prices were, gas were so high, to get rid of your SUV economically did not make sense. I mean, it doesn't make sense to get rid of a $30,000 car because you're paying a buck more a gallon for gas.
No, it
was a panic because suddenly... you look foolish if you're driving a big car like that. So that's what influences us.
So
it's not the economics.
A lot of times it's just the stories that we're telling ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Well, I was going to put out the phone number, but there's too many numbers already, so I'll put out the email, talk@APRN.org. And, we lost our Eagle River caller, did we? Okay. Well, then, I guess there's nothing left but to go to Tom from Homer. Tom, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, I was listening earlier to the radio on a project that was, or a different subject, but I think it relates. And it related to teachers in Washington, D.C. They were firing all the teachers because the children weren't learning. And one of the teachers pointed out that the children are all sleeping, or many of them were sleeping.
Yeah.
And what it amounts to is the health of the student and the food and drink. And I think it also applies to this coming up with solutions for saving the planet or anything else. If the body isn't healthy, you can't think of the right way to solve it. So I've been kind of beating a drum all the time on a health plan for the nation, and I've written one that is just half a page, but the politicians don't even read it. And I've called all three of them, so I don't know. But they've got to come around to the mind of the health of the mind and body to solve the solutions. And once the people are healthy, they'll solve it. But it's when you got a toothache or a backache, you can't think anything else.
Well, good point. So go ahead. I want to hear it now. It's only half a page.
Oh, you want to hear the plan?
Well, a little bit of it anyway.
Okay. Well, first off, is to open it up to all professions, not just the medical doctors, and then educate the children with references to people that are quite educated in the different fields, and teach them from kindergarten on through 12th grade.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get healthy? That's what I want to know.
How do you get healthy? By eating and drinking right, and also getting proper medical care.
You know, I think what Tom is, I really agree with this idea that you go back to education, you go back to people thinking about taking care of themselves, and it's not only in the health field, but in a bunch of other areas that maybe it's our Alaska and independent mythology about ourselves, but I really think that society works better when we teach our own kids what we believe that they need to learn, you know, so we have locally based schools that are run by communities, and we teach people to take care of their own health and to think about their bodies and all that. And that's part of just this process of creating these norms of self-sufficiency and community building. As I write in the book, you know, if you want to save the environment, have a potluck dinner because it's creating community and connection with other people, which is going to both give you a sense of sufficiency and fulfillment in your life and give you the connections you need to start creating those social norms.
I guess what's so encouraging about what you say is that it manifestly works. You've given examples.
That's right.
It works.
It works. And the other, start a school, run for the school board. That's another way to save the environment because you get results. I mean, one of the examples I really like is that, setting vehicle fuel standards was done just at the end of George W. Bush's administration. It had taken 25 years to set those CAFE standards and increase them, had a 12-year phase-in period. So all that effort by the environmental groups pushing for better gas mileage took 37 years. Okay, so that's one approach. The other approach is go volunteer in a kindergarten. Teach a six-year-old that when he gets to be 16, he doesn't need to drive a car. 10 years, much faster payback.
Then there's the whole deal of the change I've watched in my lifetime, the total change of the tobacco paradigm. When I was a kid, there were spittoons everywhere, and tobacco use was unquestioned and absolutely everywhere, particularly among men and then among women. I even remember when it was vaguely not such a good idea for women to smoke, and then all of a sudden it was. And it's gone totally the other way. And I think a lot of it is just plain kids. People are concerned about their kids, and kids don't want their parents smoking.
Yeah.
Period.
And if kids don't start smoking, then they don't start smoking typically. And the thing is that these things seem like it seems like when you've got a social norm that's always been that way. But in fact, they do change, and we've seen them change in our lifetime. And so that gives you hope that maybe we can change these social norms about the environment.
Okay, Charles Wolforth, let's try another call. This is Gene in Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, thanks, Steve. My thought is sort of along the lines of changing the social norms. And today's News Minor has a really interesting column by a man called Sheldon Richmond, who's part of the Future of Freedom Foundation, a libertarian think tank. And he talks about what he calls the dishonor of militarism, And then goes on to say that Glenn Beck didn't mention that our nation's biggest burden right now is that we're viewing the military as somehow heroic and honorable, when actually we're perpetuating an American empire that's making us more and more enemies and costing us all of far too much, at least, of our nation's wealth, and causing all sorts of enormous problems that are so expensive that we can't deal with our nation's other issues like infrastructure and education and health care.
Very eloquently put, Jean. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And I'd like to, you know, I think once again it's important to separate the individual serviceman who is in fact super pro-social. That's somebody who's volunteering for others. It's largely an altruistic activity, to how that is used by a nation or nations that are in a competitive marketplace of nations around the world, and often driven by, you know, corporate interests or by other interests.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In keeping with what you were saying about corporations, he also mentions that a bit, that many of the corporate interests are really just battering down the halls of Congress and getting all this money that people don't even think about as part of the problem of our national debt.
Yeah. Well, boy, that national debt is a whole other show, and probably a bunch of other shows. Jean, I want to thank you for your call.
You're welcome. Good day, right. Both of you.
Yeah, well, I want to thank the thoughtful people who called to engage in this very difficult subject on this program, because it's difficult, even for you and me, Charles. We kind of know one another to talk about it. It's difficult.
Yeah, well, what I'm trying to get at is some of our deepest feelings and motivations and what makes us operate and ask, well, can we look into that machinery and kind of change how it works a little bit, or at least identify how it works and bring that up to the surface? And yeah,
well, what you're saying is you want to organize, I mean, just recognizing how it actually already has been working, and yet we're persuaded that there's something twisted about these values we actually already have.
Yeah, that's right. We've kind of been taught that we're wrong about how we feel about the environment. And even when I talk to super development-oriented groups and show them pictures of Prince William Sound, they feel that same connection too. There's nobody out there who doesn't want to save these places. So why can't we do it? How do we go about bringing those values to the surface? And I enjoyed the discussion. And I also welcome people contacting me directly by email or through my website, fateofnature.com, to carry on the discussion, because it's all about talking and sort of identifying these feelings.
The Fate of Nature. Charles Wolforth has been our guest, and next week on Talk of Alaska, Mr. Tim Wise is coming to town for Healing Racism, and we'll be talking about his book, White Like Me. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.